Hello and welcome to the Heritage Radio Network and to part three, the final installment of our series, Out to Pasture, Meeting the Demand for Local Meat in New York City and Beyond. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey. In this series, of course, we're examining what it's actually going to take for farmers, slaughterhouse workers, butchers, and others to meet the growing demand for good, clean, local meat in New York City. And in the process, maybe we'll get a hint or two about how to do it nationally. In our last two episodes, we've zeroed in on the farm and the slaughterhouse and taken a look at the issues that producers are facing in those two realms. This week, we follow the local meat supply chain all the way to the consumer with episode three, The Butcher Shop. Where have all the butcher shops gone? Why do they matter? And how do you sell a cow's tongue to a consumer who's just looking for a T-bone? We'll talk with historian Roger Horowitz, author of the book Putting Meat on the American Table, and with Jake Dixon, the proprietor of a new butcher shop in Manhattan's Chelsea Market, to find out. Okay, so about 6 months ago, I cut a pig in half. Or to be more honest, I helped cut a pig in half. An 83-year-old butcher named Mo Albanese did most of the work. It was a butchering class at Mo's shop, Albanese Meats, in Manhattan's Nolita neighborhood. And Jake Dixon, who we'll talk with later in the show, was the master of ceremonies. There were two small pigs, and they hung by their hind legs on hooks along one wall of the shop. Both of them were ghostly white except for blue USDA stamps on their flanks, certifying that they'd been safely slaughtered. There were about six of us in the class, and when Jake asked who wanted to go first, I raised my hand, almost too eagerly. Grabbing a long hacksaw that had been hanging by the pigs, I grasped one of their legs for leverage and began to work. And to my surprise, it was hard work, and I got stuck several times before I relaxed and started letting the saw do the work for me. But the sound of sawing through the spine of this animal sent chills down my own spine, chills that didn't quite subside until long after the class had ended. Now, Mo's butcher shop, where we took that class, was opened by his father in 1927, and it's a relic of an earlier time. Mo told us that at one point, there were six butcher shops on his block, while today only his remains. And in the same way, the act of butchery that we performed that afternoon, breaking an entire animal down into a set of cuts, is work that relatively few butchers in Manhattan, or anywhere outside of a slaughterhouse, have had to do for decades. That's because starting in the early 1960s, the large meatpacking firms led by a company called Iowa Beef Packers, or IBP, started cutting meat in their own highly automated facilities, vacuum packing it, and shipping it to the butchers in cardboard boxes, leaving the butchers with little more to do than to slice the meat and wrap it in paper for a customer. The butcher shops had already taken a serious hit in the 1950s, when supermarkets figured out how to sell prepackaged meat to consumers. But in New York, the world of butchery and the prestige of the butcher, for that matter, had been in flux since more than 100 years before that. You could argue that it all began in 1843. See, that was the year that private butcher shops became legal in New York City. That's right, before then it was illegal to butcher or sell meat outside of one of New York's public markets. And that meant that the butchers who worked in those markets, they were very important men. They handled practically every step of processing an animal, slaughtering, butchering, displaying, and selling. And if they didn't slaughter the animal themselves, then a wholesale butcher would do it for them. Now, because of the skills required for all of this, and the stakes, this was, after all, the city's only legal meat supply, becoming a master butcher sometimes required as much training time as medical school does today. It took an apprenticeship of 4 to 7 years. Butchers, who often wore top hats, used to be sworn in by the city, like public servants. Now, once private butcher shops became legal in the 1840s, that meant, of course, that everyone and their cousin Vinny could become a butcher, and the top hats came off. But there was yet another bump in the road coming for New York City's honorable men of meat. See, in the 1880s, a man named Gustavus Swift, who was actually my great-great-great-grandfather, started slaughtering cattle in Chicago and shipping their carcasses east by train for sale in New York. This left the men in the storefront butcher shops with some cutting to do, but the wholesale butchers, the ones that bought the animals, slaughtered them, and resold them, they were in trouble. The efficiencies of Swift's business, from his huge scale to the money he saved by shipping loads lighter than his competitors, their animals were alive after all, while his was dead. These things allowed him to set prices lower than any butcher who sourced locally. And in the end, all that many wholesale butchers could do was become dealers for Swift or find another profession. Swift's innovation was a huge boon to consumers, but it transformed New York's butchering trade. So it might seem from the picture that I've just painted that New York's neighborhood butcher shops, you know, the social hubs where people gather to chew the fat, where butchers save certain cuts for the regulars, it might seem like these places have mostly gone by the wayside. But in recent years, a strange thing has started to happen. A new crop of butcher shops is popping up throughout the city. And in many ways, these establishments look more like the typical 19th century butcher shop than the supermarket deli that's taken its place. Early in 2009, I visited one of these, a shop called Marlowe and Daughters in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It was a sunny shop, fronted by large windows, with a long glass display case that ran the length of the room. One look inside the case, though, was all it really took to realize that this was not your typical butcher shop. Whole pig's legs and the head of a sheep were scattered among the cuts of meat. There was an entire cow tongue, black and white in color, which was labeled the Tickler. There was also the entire heart of a cow, and this was labeled Captain Beefheart. In the rear of the shop, there was a large meat locker, and through a window, a customer could see massive hunks of beef hanging from hooks in the ceiling. And this is what made Marlowe and Daughters different. Rather than getting meat vacuum-sealed and boxed up from the large packers, the shop sourced whole animals from local farms. Hence the strange bits of anatomy sitting under that glass. You see, at Marlowe and Daughters, they had no choice but to use every part of the animal that they could. And as it turns out, this is what makes butcher shops such an important part of the supply chain for locally produced artisanal meats. In a small farm, small slaughterhouse environment like New York State, the slaughterhouses that farmers trust to handle their meat are often not going to process animals down to cuts small enough for the individual consumer. And in part, that's because they're not large enough to make a profitable business out of all the non-edible animal parts, the excess fat, the hides, the hooves. Butcher shops, on the other hand, can make soups, head cheese, sausage, and can even sell some of the more exotic parts, the Captain Beefhearts, the Ticklers, directly to curious consumers. So in a local meat economy, butchers do a lot to reduce waste. And for the rest of the show, we're going to talk about the evolution of butchery in New York City and the current state of the butchery landscape. After a break, we'll be back with historian Roger Horowitz to talk about what first turned New Yorkers on to meat from far away, and how butchery in the city today is a different animal than it used to be.
Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
We're back with our first guest, but first, a quick note. This show and many others are available online at heritageradionetwork.com or as a podcast on iTunes. Now, our first guest is Roger Horowitz. He's Associate Director at the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at the Hagley Museum of American Enterprise, just outside of Wilmington, Delaware. And he's the author of several books, among them the 2006 work, Putting Meat on the American Table, from which much of the information in this series is drawn. Roger Horowitz, welcome to the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, Nelson, thanks for having me here.
Pleasure to have you here. Now, in your book, you discuss the fact that consumers in New York may have had some reservations about meat slaughtered far from the point of sale or several days before the time of sale, the way that Swift's beef was. And I'm wondering, what was it that eventually warmed them up to meat from far away?
Well, it's funny you say warmed up. I mean, once upon a time in 19th century New York, when you got your beef or your pork, it was slaughtered right nearby, and you got it the next day. And that changed when the Chicago plants got built in the 1880s, and it became shipped in chilled form. The big reason that New Yorkers were open to this was price. It was a whole lot cheaper to buy what was called chilled beef in New York City. And what the meat companies did is they established warehouses where butchers could go and get this chilled meat, which they could then bring to their store and sell to their customers. And I suspect that a lot of New Yorkers didn't even know that they were buying meat that was killed in Chicago rather than down the street in New York City. They just found that meat was suddenly cheaper, and the butchers probably discovered that there wasn't that much resistance to it, and so they became customers for the chilled beef.
People weren't having a problem with it, and it was so much cheaper anyway that they just sort of went for it.
Well, in New York City, you know, like then as now, they were wealthy and they were poor. And if you were a poor person, it was probably a big improvement on the kinds of beef that you could get. You know, you probably could get better beef from Chicago than you were getting from New York City in terms of quality cuts. Now, if you're wealthy and you wanted to buy the best beef, you probably could ask for New York killed beef if you wanted to pay a premium for that. So what you probably had were the cheaper grades going to the working people, the chilled beef, and you probably still had folks who were epicures who felt there was a difference in flavor who preferred the local meat.
Sure. So if the low price of Western beef that Swift slaughtered in Chicago did play a large role in convincing New Yorkers to buy it, I'm wondering, even after Western meat became the stuff that most New Yorkers were eating sometime in the 1890s or so, was there still a market for local meat in New York, and to what extent were producers able to supply that local market?
Well, there was a huge market in beginning, really, in the 1890s, and that was the Jews. A huge migration into New York City in the beginning of the 1880s, but really peaking throughout the 1890s. And it probably saved the local meat slaughtering industry. Jews overwhelmingly were kosher, and part of kosher law is that the meat was supposed to be eaten within 3 days after it was slaughtered. That was the rule back then. So it was simply not feasible to get kosher slaughtered meat shipped from Chicago plants so quickly. So this provided a huge stimulus to a local meatpacking industry. And it's the case, I just looked at some statistics here, that in 1909, New York City was the third largest meatpacking center in the United States after Chicago and Kansas City, overwhelmingly because of the kosher market. Now, where did they get the meat from? Well, they weren't getting it from New Jersey and Long Island, I assure you. They were getting it from the same place the Chicago plants were getting it. They were getting it from the plains of Iowa and Illinois, and the cattle were coming on rail cars, shipped through Pennsylvania, through New York State, unloaded at stockyards in New Jersey, some cases killed at plants in New Jersey, but in many cases shipped across the rivers to slaughterhouses in what's now where the United Nations is. And that's where the big plants were, and they were killed there and sent to wholesalers and to retail shops in New York City.
Sure, interesting. So I want to shift a little bit. We're talking about butchery in this half hour, and in the last century and a half, the butchery profession has undergone some pretty dramatic changes. I'd like to talk about some of those changes. First, can you explain how the job and the social standing of butchers changed when private butcher shops were first legalized in New York in the 1840s?
Well, you take us back to an era which it's hard for people to understand, that prior to 1841, you were not allowed to operate a private butcher shop in New York City. You had to sell your meat through public markets. They were owned by the city, and you obtained licenses to sell your meat in this manner. And back in those days, butchers were the old colonial craftsmen. If you were a butcher, you probably bought the animal yourself. You probably slaughtered it yourself. You cut it up, and then you brought it to market yourself. You either sold it personally to the customers, maybe your wife sold it to the customers, and then one of your assistants probably carried it to their house. So you were the livestock buyer. You were the slaughterhouse worker. You were the wholesale butcher, you were the retail butcher, and you also were the storekeeper, all wrapped into one. Now, when they legalized butcher shops in the 1840s, that all changed. Then it was possible to break the trade up into different tasks. you started to have slaughterhouse workers whose main job was killing. Then you had wholesale butchers whose main job was taking these animals, cutting them up into retail cuts, and selling them to the retail stores. And then, of course, you had the butchers who were operating in retail stores. And butcher shops spread throughout the city. And for the next 100 years, that's really how you got your meat in New York City. You went to a local butcher shop. And that's really the structure then for a good long period of time, slaughterhouse workers, wholesale butchers, and your retail butchers.
And so you've got private butcher shops being legalized in the 1840s. That's more than 150 years ago. But can you talk about how the trade and the stature of butchers has changed in the years since then?
Well, there are a couple big changes that happened beginning in the 1950s. One big change is we start having something called self-serve meat, which, of course, is the way that people used to buy their meat today, those packaged meat in under plastic wrap in the supermarkets. Before the 1950s, you pretty much got your meat by a butcher who cut it to order. But beginning in the 1950s and certainly by the 1960s, it became more common for supermarkets to sell you meat that had been pre-cut. Now, this changed the butcher trade a great deal, because rather than the butcher standing there selling you the meat, they are in the back room or in the supermarket warehouses working by themselves, cutting up the meat for wrapping for consumer cuts. That meant the butchers were not as autonomous. They were under more control by the supermarkets, and there was a lot of resentment on the part of butchers to be pushed away from being on the retail floor and into the back room where no one could see them. Now, that's one big change, and then that's compounded beginning in the 1970s with something called boxed beef. Now, what boxed beef is the way we get meat today, and it reflects that the meat we get today has been boned and cut up into somewhat large chunks back in the slaughterhouses in Iowa and Kansas and places like that.
Sure.
It used to be that what you got was a quarter of the animal, and the butcher then, and again, these are your 1950s butchers, your 1930s butchers, would cut it into pieces for consumer use. So once you have this boxed beef, it all changes, because all that skilled work is being done by workers standing on assembly lines, chopping up the meat into small pieces. These are the workers, by the way, who are getting carpal tunnel syndrome and are suffering a great deal in these packing houses. So the butchers in today's supermarkets, what they're doing is they're getting meat which has been boned and cut, and they're not doing the kind of butchering which they once did. And the trade, and certainly the numbers of butchers that are employed, has gone down a great deal.
Sure, sure. Well, Roger Horowitz, historian, the author of the 2006 book, Putting Meat on the American Table, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, well, thank you, and good luck with the show.
After a break, we'll be back with Jake Dixon, the proprietor of a soon-to-open butcher shop in Manhattan's Chelsea Market and the possessor of a self-accredited degree that he calls the Masters of Meat. Stay with us.
Down anyway. Well, I think you're making too
And we're back. A quick note to our listeners, this show and many others is available online at heritageradionetwork.com or as a podcast on iTunes. And I'm here with Jake Dixon, proprietor of Dixon's Farm Stand Meats, company that sources whole animals from farms in upstate New York and sells the meat to customers in New York City. He cut his teeth in the meat biz through a year of jobs and apprenticeships at several farms, a butcher shop, and a slaughterhouse, and he just opened up a butcher shop of his own in Manhattan's Chelsea Market. Now, a surprise to listeners, we've traveled in time and space. I'm with Jake Dixon, but we're no longer in the Heritage Radio studio. We are in the back of Dixon's brand spanking new butcher shop in Manhattan's Chelsea Market. We're right near the large walk-in freezer. There's a large glass display case up front, chock full of local meats. The shop is spare, it's simple, it looks very good. Jake Dixon, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Happy to be here.
All right, so to business. Up to now, you've been acting as a sort of a purveyor for local meat, buying from upstate farms as you were doing that day and selling at New York farmers markets and online. But you just entered a new phase of your business. You opened up a butcher shop. Can you talk about how the butcher shop's going to add value to the business that you already had?
Sure. Previously, we were buying from local farms and everything was butchered upstate and we were selling a great quality product. But the problem is that while the farmers markets, I think, are a great intermediary step in that you can get a high quality product locally raised into the hands of consumers, there's a level of service that really needs to be coming with meat that it lacks, and that being that we can do fresh and cut to order out of a butcher shop. And we can do all the value add products and to control the whole product from whole animal down to retail cutting. There's a lot written about the problem with slaughterhouses. There's not enough slaughterhouses in the Northeast. But in my mind, the real problem is not a lack of slaughterhouses. It's a lack of processing facilities. And for us, we were having these animals butchered all over at different facilities. That meant, every butcher has a different style of packaging and cutting. So the product we were selling wasn't consistently butchered and packaged. So that was, the customer would see a different product every week often, even though the meat was the same. As well as we couldn't do anything custom. And, custom cutting is what being in the meat business, in my mind, is all about. Rather than having to push a product to a customer saying, I have 1¼-inch thick porterhouses, we get now in a butcher shop say, how thick would you like your porterhouse cut? In addition, we're able to go fresh. A lot of people want to buy their meat, rather than frozen, which, high-quality product when frozen correctly is still a high-quality product. But here, people can take our product home and cook it as soon as they get home, which is important to a lot of New Yorkers, as well as in addition to the cutting everything here, we can do all the value-added products ourselves. So we're making all of our own sausages. Very shortly, our kitchen will be open. We put in a smoker at the 600-pound capacity, so we'll be doing all of our own bacons and hams. We're taking it from the only thing that we're not doing is raising the animals and slaughtering them, and we're picking up from the slaughterhouse, and we'll be doing everything, including all the value adds here in our butcher shop in Chelsea Market.
And operating a shop that sources whole animals rather than boxed meats, you're going to wind up with a lot of pieces of meat that the average consumer isn't familiar with. I mean, somebody just came in and asked for beef suet, which is an unusual thing. Can you talk about sort of the importance of introducing people to new parts of the animal and how you plan to do that?
Sure, it's something that we were most apprehensive about. A lot of people are used to coming in and just buying steaks that they're familiar with. So we were worried, are we going to be able to convince people to buy cuts they're not as familiar with, even if they're great? And I must say we've had it's been easier than we even thought. People are excited to try new things. Now, a lot of that comes with pushing ourselves as a different kind of butcher shop. If you just open up and you're a regular kind of boxed beef kind of shop,
standard, right?
Standard shop, then, the expectation will be different. But by really pushing it as we are a whole animal shop, we bring in the pigs, come split in half. Lambs come in whole and beef come in 4 pieces. Pretty much the largest pieces of meat you can handle outside of a slaughterhouse with rails. So we kind of make sure that's front and center to everyone, so the expectation is different. And, the people we have behind our counter are not just pushing what's in the case. It's more that we're having conversations about cooking methods. So when somebody walks in, we say, what are you making? How do you want to cook tonight? So are you want to braise something? Do you want to roast something? Do you want to sear something? We're not saying, do you want a New York strip, or I have a bunch of New York strips here for you. So we're trying to have engage with our customers, help them with cooking methods, help them make the best dinner. You know, based on what they want to do that night, we're going to suit them with a cut. And we're confident that the people we have behind the counter have that level of knowledge that, you know, we can execute it correctly.
Sure, sure. Shifting gears a little bit, with butchery, experiencing this kind of resurgence in popularity, there's a concern that a lot of these new butchers coming up haven't received adequate training. I wonder if you could talk about, you know, why you think that is, and the sort of training that you think a butcher today ought to receive.
You know, I think that everybody, you know, we have a lot of different people in different stages, and I think a lot of people are doing great things. You know, I was looking for someone with a tremendous level of experience, so I hired a man named Adam Tiberio, great guy. He's only 26, but has a tremendous level of experience. He's worked in multiple supermarket programs, Whole Foods and Stop and Shop when he was, 17, 18, 19, and then basically put himself through college working in a slaughterhouse outside of Boston. And then since then worked in a few butcher shops in the Boston area. So he really has that from, you know, hoof to retail cutting experience that few people have. Now, a lot of, you know, I think our popularity of people wanting butchers, you know, with the local focus and natural focus has kind of outpaced the training available. So, you know, people are doing a lot of learning themselves, which I think is a great way to start as well. And I think that level of knowledge in the city and elsewhere is just going to keep expanding, and people get better and better at cutting. And, you know, I think everybody in all stages is great for the industry. Now, I feel fortunate to have Adam. I also have Gabe, who's my chef, who we sent up to a program, a 1 month from slaughter through retail cutting program up at SUNY Cobleskill that they ran for the first time, that's trying to address that lack of experience of training available for cutters and for slaughterhouse employees. So there, it seems as though there are more formal training programs coming up. We definitely need more of them. You know, there aren't that many places, especially in New York City, where you can get this experience, and I think that's a big problem. You can't learn how to cut a whole animal unless you go to a place that's doing a lot of whole animal butchery. And that, even in our shop, you know, we're talking at most we're doing 4 beef a week, 8 pigs a week, 8 to 10 lambs a week. So while that's high volume, that's nothing compared to what you'd get if you went to work in a slaughterhouse where all day long all you do is cut.
Right. That Adam Tiberio did.
Exactly.
And speaking of him, I wanted to ask you sort of kind of segues nicely into my next question, which is about this sort of hipster butcher phenomenon that, I mean, comes largely out of this piece in the New York Times back in July, mm-hmm. talked about the sex appeal of butchers. But Adam Tiberio was mentioned, he was photographed prominently in that. And I wanted to ask you sort of, where do you think this is coming from, this popularity, this kind of sexy butcher thing, and what good, if any, can come of it?
We're pretty anti the sexy butcher thing. I think it's great that people have taken the interest in what we do, but we wish it was in a more serious way. You know, Adam, while I believe he is a sexy man, you know, I think that it's a little silly, this whole sexy butcher thing. Most importantly, Adam is a great guy and a great cutter, you know, and that's how he sees himself. He thinks it's more ridiculous than anybody, this kind of seeing butchers as rock stars. You know, he thinks
the practical experience that he's had, I'm sure.
Right, he thinks he takes great pride in what he does, but it's as a cutter with a tremendous amount of experience and always continually trying to learn. You know, he doesn't even like to refer to himself as a butcher, even though he has tremendous experience. He refers to himself as a meat cutter. You know, I think coming from his background, he's self-conscious about that term because there's always people doing things better, faster than him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jake Dixon, proprietor of Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in the Chelsea Market, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
Well, my friends, we have come at last to the final chapter of our Little Meat Odyssey here today. Over the last 3 weeks, we've examined the nuts and bolts of the farm, the slaughterhouse, and the butcher shop, three critical links in New York City's local meat food chain. In this series, we've been through a lot of history, and we've talked a lot about a time a couple of centuries ago when New York could meet most of its appetite for meat by drawing on local resources. Let me be clear. My purpose in doing this is not to suggest that New York could get back there anytime soon. There are millions more people living in the city, eating much more meat than was the case in the 1800s. Particularly if all of our meat was raised entirely on pasture, we simply wouldn't have enough land in this region to produce what we eat. So it's likely that for a while yet, most of our meat will continue to come from quite a distance. But my purpose in looking through history has been to see whether there are bits and pieces of that antiquated infrastructure that we might revitalize for our own purposes, or lessons that we might learn from a time when farmland, slaughterhouses, and butcher shops, all now scarce, were plentiful. I've also asked throughout this series how much New York's local meat industry is likely to grow. As popular as it has become to eat locally, local artisanal meat often remains a luxury of those who can afford to pay the premium that it often implies. And if more people are going to start eating local meat, it'll have to become cheaper. And if it's going to become cheaper, the farms producing it will probably have to become bigger. Whether they can do so without sacrificing the same standards of quality and safety that made them attractive in the first place remains to be seen. And I don't have the answer. But if you've listened to this series and you eat meat, my only hope is that the next time you eat a steak, you think about it. And you really freaking taste it, because it's delicious. Thanks to Lorenzo Reggianeri and Nat Wiener, the Heritage Radio producer and engineer, respectively. And thanks to you for listening.